last year is the first in the series called Rereading from the Beginning, where I wanted to try and present a series of questions about what the proper way to read Voracious is. And so last year is titled, Is Voracious About Philosophy? Okay, so in order to answer the question, Is Voracious About Philosophy? We have to fundamentally answer two questions first, or offer two definitions, one of which is, what is philosophy? And the other is, what does it mean for a book to be about? So we're going to start with, what is philosophy? So here's the so the most recent attempt at a philosophic reading of Genesis is by a University of Chicago professor named Leon Katz, has a book called The Beginning of Wisdom, and this is from his introduction. He said, this book offers a philosophic reading of the book of Genesis. Well, you may well ask, what do you mean by philosophic reading? So by philosophic, I mean wisdom-seeking and wisdom-loving, after the literal meaning of the ancient Greek term philosophia, the love and pursuit of wisdom. Philosophy in this original sense refers not to some specialized academic subject matter, the field of philosophy, or to some finished doctrine, my philosophy of life, or to some method of reasoning and questioning practiced by card-carrying professional philosophers, the discipline of philosophy. Rather, it denotes the activity of Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and any of their descendants who single-mindedly and wholeheartedly, that's a really good line. Single-mindedly and wholeheartedly, I really like that. Yet thoughtfully and self-critically, seek to discover the truth about the world and our place within it, and to find thereby guidance for how we are to live. Okay. I don't know how useful that is, truthfully. It's a really nice paragraph. At the end of it, it pretty much means the philosophy of whatever you really care about. Or the philosophy, philosophy tells you good stuff that you need to know. So it's not going to work. And that raised, and the fact that this definition, I think, doesn't work tells us that this is a really challenging issue. Because if you read Professor Katz's book, you will discover that, in fact, there is something that is distinctive about his book. It's distinctively a philosophic reading. Although, interestingly, what it tells you fundamentally is that, in many ways, the way Chazal read Torah is what we would now recognize as being philosophic. What it really just means is that you read Torah with an eye towards really caring about what it teaches you, and an assumption that what it teaches you is important. And it's really interesting how, if you just make those assumptions, you end up reading like Chazal. But I want to take the question more in the terms that he denies, and say that there are five what we might call disciplines or fields in philosophy, and as opposed to just saying that I want to read Voracious philosophically means that I want ideas to come out of Voracious that matter, I want to ask the question whether Voracious can legitimately and convincingly be read as being about one or more of these five issues. So the first, what we call epistemology, which is how we know things. Right? Does Voracious tell me the proper way to arrive at truth? For example, does it tell me that I should think about everything on my own? Or conversely, does it tell me that I ought not to think about anything on my own? I should merely accept traditions? Or that I should assume that all truth is contained within revelation, and that I should apply reason to the Torah but not care about anything outside Torah? And those are all legitimate questions in epistemology. How do I know things? Does Voracious tell me anything about that? Or does it just assume it? Or does it leave that up to me? And go ahead and figure that out. Second question we call theology, which is, does Voracious seek to tell me the nature of God? And that relates to all sorts of questions. It can relate to abstractions about the nature of God, such as, does it seek to tell me that God is one, that God is omnipresent, that God is above time, all those sorts of issues? Or is it really not so much interested in abstractions about God? In fact, it's just interested in telling me how I ought to relate to God. It's a very different question. Third issue is metaphysics, which is, theology is sometimes included within it, but I'm breaking it out today, which is that it tells me things what I call about the nature of reality as such. Voracious might tell me, for example, whether if I look around this room, I should believe that there are actual things in this room, or whether the only thing, whether when a tree falls in the forest, it makes no sound because nothing exists unless human beings perceive it. It might tell me the proper relationship between matter and form. It might tell me whether the universe is infinite or the universe is finite. How many dimensions there are in the world, right? Although that has now magically become part of physics instead of metaphysics. All sorts of issues like that. It might be that anthropology. Spencer writes that what gracious is really about is about the fundamental nature of what it means to be human. And the most famous anthropological readings of gracious that are often nowadays are offered by Thoreau. And Lonely Man of Faith is read as an extended argument that gracious is about anthropology. It's about what human beings are like, and specifically, there are two versions of the story that tell us something about, tell us about human beings having a dual nature. That's also the argument that Rose makes in Magic to Humility, and many other places, and we will address that in more detail when we have to share in response to church criticism. Okay, finally, gracious could be about ethics. I mean, that's teaching us how properly to behave. We've no issue with any abstractions beyond that. The most extreme version of that would be what we would call the Rugachev reading of gracious. Rugachev, rather, wrote a book in which he provided halachic significance to every narrative in Chumash. My favorite is that when it says that the Akedah, the Avraham, right, that Avraham went and he took the idol, that teaches us the proper method of acquiring objects in Hefker. And obviously, fundamentally, the import of narrative is to teach me halakha. Okay, you don't have to frame it in terms of law, you can frame it in terms of ethics, but gracious is all about teaching us how we ought to behave, not about abstractions, not about self-knowledge, not about God, not about the broad nature of reality, and not about how we ought to know things. If you don't know how to know things already, then it doesn't really help you to read anything if you don't know how to trust what you read anyway. Those are the five fields of philosophy that are that need to be addressed. Now, what does it mean to be a doubt? Now, to be a doubt is kind of a hard question. What is a book to be about? So, for example, let's suppose I would say what this poem teaches me is that human beings always strive towards God. But often, as they're in the process of striving towards God, something happens and they get knocked down. But it is in the nature of human beings that no matter how often they get knocked back towards their animal nature, nonetheless, human beings continually strive upwards towards God and seeking to overcome the forces of their nature. Now, that can be a reading of Bereshit. It's also a really good reading of the Ifidusi Spider. So the question is, is there a sense in which you can legitimately say that Bereshit is more about that than the Ifidusi Spider? Okay? So now here I want to talk about one of the classical medieval modes of saying that gracious is about philosophy was something called allegory. Right, allegory assumed that all the episodes in gracious were actually about abstractions. And I'll say that the attack on allegory that I'm going to give you right now, which gives me a sense of why people thought this was dangerous, is from the response of the Rashba. This is source number two. Now, the Rashba wrote in classic medieval Hebrew writing prose, and I tried briefly and realized that it would take me a long time to get the English to rhyme, and that sound really silly. But I apologize, I can't do it for you. The English does not capture the fun of the Zayanimor Ordinaris Kavans Hasridim, the Kinamik Yatama Dot Mashad Yudim, Kishama Hashem of Kima Kero Pater, Akacham Yashay, Yashay, Hashem, Kiyashay, Van Kilchamot, the Dibri Tera Soter, etc., etc. And all, they have to recognize that this is the mode of writing. You wrote in rhyming prose. It's quite mocking. But here's what he's attacking. He's saying that Ve'lamut enei kol kol Yisrael, Tartim enei hakol v'drei ha-Torah, that they're breaching in public view all the boundaries of Torah. V'yach avotenach yoshim sholchu b'shanam, and even about our holy ancestors, towards our holy ancestors, they send their tongues. Mashal afu avdei avadazara. Even the idolaters don't, right? What the people who think that gracious is an allegory do is worse than anything done by the idolaters. The idolaters believe that our ancestors were real. But what these people do is they say, Ki Yamru Abraham Vasara, Ki Yamkomer Vasira. They say, right, that Abraham and Sarah really are just representations, respectively, of form and matter. And Abraham is form and Sarah is matter, and all the relationships in Abraham and Sarah and their marriage and the production of Yitzhak, all that is just talking about the way in which reality is produced by the intersection of form and matter. Israel, okay, the 12 tribes of Israel are just representations of the 12 signs of the zodiac. As Brian goes, all right, if anybody heard any sort of has funny, that from the day that the Aris was divided, the Gulot, meaning from the time that if you take Kumash literally, Eretz Yisrael was divided among the 12 tribes, if anybody heard of such nonsense, was that the 12 tribes, were not actually real, and it's really just talking about the division of the universe into the 12 sections of the zodiac. But nobody's ever heard anything this terrible, right? They would in fact return the entire world back to Tohu Bohu. They say, this is my favorite. That is my favorite one. The war of the four kings and the five kings is really about the war between the four fundamental elements and the five senses. Okay, so Rashba, right, the Rashba hates this. It says, Kiyom Rubik says, Tam, the Tam of the day, Kikol Mashi Yesi Parshat, Reshida Zmakam Surah, Hakol Mashal. What they say is that everything in the Torah, all the narrative in the Torah, from the opening until Sinai, everything up until that is nothing but a series of veiled philosophic statements. It's all about what I would call metaphysics. Right? It's all about the fundamental nature of reality. It's certainly not about history. Okay, the understands that, you know what, he doesn't really believe, that these people actually stop him up in Torah either. They're going to think that all of the mitzvot are allegories also. Right? They're going to think that there's no reason to put black boxes on your head and hands, right? That you're really just a photograph, right? That's really just a metaphor. And he ends up thinking that people who think that the Torah is fundamentally about philosophy rather than about history are also fringy in part. Okay. That's a pretty harsh statement, yes. He was attacking some of the maybe the Abraham of Marseille or something like that. But, you know, my purpose, you know, there's a pretty good historical figure that he's writing the attack against. But there is a genuine school that interpreted him going back to Philo, right, that understands Torah in this way. And there is it's an interesting proposition. Right? You can, right, you know, that if you are a medieval allegory, this is a plausible way of reading it. I actually have my favorite reading this way. My favorite wild extension of this is that the War of the Four Kings and the Five Kings is the elements and the senses. But a really good reading, which I think is suggested by Radak, although I hesitate to say that Radak means it, but to me it was suggested by Radak, is that the story of the flood is as follows. Now, what's the point of the story of the flood? It's that every species survives, and human beings are just like every other species. Right? They survive in a set of breeding pairs. The only difference is that God knows the names of human beings. And that's an allegory to the proposition that that God's providence extends to species in regard to every species of the human, where God's providence extends to individuals. Right? It's a really neat way of reading the entire flood story. Next question.
They grew out of a radical reading of the Rambam's kind of Perplex, and something that convulsed the Jewish communities of southern France and northern Spain, and it's kind of throughout the 13th century modern city. It's a big deal.
Can we assume that the Rambam is taking this position? Because these people are saying that if you take it as mashal,
you
were denying
that
history. Sure. If you were to take the book and say that it's history, and
this
history itself is mashal, would the Rashba have the same?
Absolutely. So I would say the Rashba seems to present that the problem with Bereshit being about philosophy is that it's not clear that Bereshit can be about philosophy and be real. And be history. Right? That's his problem. But maybe you can have it both ways. For example, I use the example of Tillum specifically because there's some famously has it both ways. He says the pshat is that you should treat Torah as it, right, as if you were writing it on your arm and between your right and between your forehead. Now the Midrash Halakha is that you have to take black boxes of parchments in them and put them in the appropriate places. And Hassan is perfectly happy living with the statement that the text is about both. It's about the metaphor, it's about the halakha, and the text can be about both simultaneously. So, for example, when Ramban says, Ma'aseh Avot Siman Lebanim, what happens to the Avot is what happens to Klal Yisrael, the rest of history. So, Rabban Elfer one is willing to say not just that what happens with Abraham foreshadows what happens to his descendants, because Abraham is a paradigmatic figure and we are all living out his life. In that reading, there's no problem, because what happened to Abraham really happened. It just is that whatever happened to Abraham lives symbolically, but Abraham is willing to say that it happened to Abraham so as to teach us about the future. And not that what Abraham, everything Abraham does automatically, right, becomes a symbol because that's where Abraham lives, but it happened to Abraham because Abraham's life is supposed to be symbolic, so God set it up so things would happen to him, would have symbolic value. Now, in that type of reading, the story is literally true, but it's not about what happened to Abraham. In that vision, Bereishis is about eschatology. Bereishis is about what's going to happen in all of history and the end of history, but it doesn't mean it's not true. So you can argue that Abraham and Sarah lived their lives in such a way that, right, in such a way that Abraham's life, Abraham and Sarah's life happened to be emblematic of the relationship between matter and form in the production, right, in the production of reality. You have to figure out how convincing you can find that. Now, for capitalists, this is not difficult at all, because capitalists believe, the Torah of the center, if I'm discerning this, that there's a one-to-one correspondence at every level of reality. So everything in this world automatically has ramifications in metaphysical universes, and everything that happens in this world automatically is some way representative of something, right, something metaphysical. Is that fair? Okay, right, so there are ways which you can have, right, there are ways, I know this from the Talmud, but I don't want to overgeneralize. So there are ways which you can have it. Now, I've argued actually in a different context in terms of the Shira Shirin, that it works the other way also. That in order for any allegory to work, how does an allegory work? An allegory makes something that you wouldn't understand in your experience by saying, look, something in your experience, which you can understand, is a good metaphor for something you don't yet understand. So Shira Shirin, for example, when people have discussions about whether Shira Shirin, the firm position is that Shira Shirin is an allegory. Right, and the heretical position is that Shira Shirin is literal. So then I argue that the point is, you know, when people say, well, Shira Shirin can't be an allegory, it's such a good love song, and it weren't a good love song, it wouldn't be an allegory either. Right, the only reason that Shira Shirin can usefully teach us about the relationship between human beings and God, as the Rav says, or between the Jews and the Jewish people and God, as no traditional interpretation says, is because it presents the convincing display of human relationship that we understand. It says, look, the relationship between the Jews and God is just like this human relationship you already understand. So the word a good love story would be a bad allegory. Right? If we ended up reading Shira Shirin and said, well, that's an unconvincing relationship, then we would say, oh, the relationship between Jews and God is an unconvincing relationship. That would be bad. Right? So Bereishis has to be, right? So Shira Shirin has to be a good love story in order to be a good allegory. But the same token, right? So the stories in Bereishis would have to be convincing human stories. It at least has to be possible for them to happen in order for them to be useful allegories in that way. Okay, so that's a, in a sense, the claim that Bereishis is about philosophy, when you use the argument about allegory, which uses the relationship, right? There's a way in which you can say it's an allegory in that, you know, really it's just in code, and we throw in the story to fool the rest of you. But we know that really Avram stands for form and Sarah stands for matter, and that Avram was 99 years old, that is not the slightest stuff, that was just there, so some of you would think it was a story. Right, that doesn't work, right? That doesn't work. But once we say that every detail of the story is significant in the allegory, then you can't really tell. But, right, because it will work, it will make sense on the first level, it will make sense, right? And any really good human story is a good metaphor for the relationship of human being and God, too. And in some sense, right, so the human beings are the Talmud Elohim. So that argument, in a sense, I think you can never answer the question of whether Gracious is the best philosophy if you just want to ask the question of whether the human relationship in Gracious can stand for relationship between beings and God. So that question actually doesn't interest me so much. The question is there anything in the text which will tell us specifically that Gracious is about certain aspects of philosophy? It's trying to teach us certain abstractions as opposed to giving us an account of what, right, an account of what happened to a specific human being at a specific point, at a specific point in time. So here I wanted to begin, here we'll turn to the sheet we handed out before this, but Midrash, right, to recognize that to some degree this is a question of presumptions. What are the presuppositions about what Chumash is you bring to the text? So Rashi, the first Rashi, begins by saying, Amar Yitzchagloya Tzarikla Tzilat Torah, Elam Ha'chodesh Adelchem, Shehi Mitzvah Shanash Nitzavu Ba'Yisrael. Yitzchak said the Torah had no need to begin with anything other than the first mitzvah given to the Jews. So all of the same parts that Rashba denounces people for saying are allegory, Rav Yitzchak doesn't say they're allegory, he says they're unnecessary. Right? And everything that precedes commandments of the Jewish people doesn't belong in Chumash. Now, what kind of question is this? Why doesn't it belong in Chumash? Right, so I think that, you know, that we have to ask the question, what doesn't really belong in Chumash? Could be that in the depth of the story of creation doesn't belong in Chumash, but we understand everything after the seventh day, that's fine. Is it that everything before Avraham doesn't belong in Chumash? Is it that stories just don't belong in Chumash? Chumash is really just a question of halakha. And he's using Gracious as an example, but he really thinks that much of Amidbar, right, you know, Pinchas and Balak, those don't belong there either, because Chumash is supposed to be a law book. Right, so by asking this question, Amidbar is saying fundamentally that he believes Gracious is about something, and the conception of what Gracious is about that he begins with is not compatible with Chumash as we have it. Okay, now the question is, right, so he wakes up in the morning and he says, I know what God would tell me. But if there were a God and he would tell me something, this is what he would tell me. He would tell me the mitzvah. And then he discovers, there's a dress, that there actually is a God, and God has spoken to him, and didn't just tell him mitzvah. Right? He told him in the beginning God created the set, etc. So now, right, Rav Yitzchak has this big problem. What does he do with this God who thinks things are important that this God ought not to think are important? Okay? So the Yitzchak Rashi says, the Yitzchak's response is, this is right here. Because, right, there's a pasuk in Tehillim which says, Krach ma'asav yigid la'mo l'teg lam nach la'at goyim. And if everyone else says to the Jews, you are robbers because you conquered the land of the seven nations, the Jews can say to them, no, God created everything and he can give it to whomever he wants. Okay, so what the Torah is about mitzvot to the Jews. What Gracious is about is our right to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, right, that's what gets close to it. It's not about philosophy. It's not about anything. It's just about, right, Gracious is just a very, very long title deed. Okay, if I wanted to read it philosophically, I would discover that what it means is that God has not bound any rules. He can do whatever he wants. Right, but it was their land, and he took it to them, and he gave it to us. Who cares? He can do whatever he wants. It's not the world's most edifying philosophical lesson, from my perspective. Some people might like it. I happen to really not like that reading. I'm much more in favor of reading to the sin that God is bound by the same standards that we are, however that happens philosophically. Okay. Now, Rashbam answering the same, or at least a similar question, says that the whole reason this part was here is just because when God said at Sinai, so the reason you should keep Shabbos is because I created the world in 6 days and I rested on the seventh, you should understand that, by the way, you can make that up. That's our assumption, right? So the Jews would know, right? That is why Moshe said this to the children of Israel, to inform them that the word of God is true. To believe that the world of God, that the world was always built up the way you presently see it, so every good thing was not so, rather, in the beginning God created, and etc. Okay, so what Rashbam does is he sort of preserves the halakhic tension vision, that really all of Chumash is about God's commands, but some commands require a background. And so Bereishis is the background to a certain set of commands. Okay, all of these positions, I have to say, to me, are every bit as shocking as the position of the Dalton allegory. Alright, because they make the events fundamentally meaningless in their own right. Right? They're just there as explanations, right, as explanations for other things. And I always thought that, you know, we were supposed to believe that every word of Torah was equally important and intrinsic in its own right. So I actually find these positions quite theologically startling. Yes, sir, Sandy.
I think you could he's countering basically the Aristotelian argument that the world still isn't here as it is, and he's always talked about the opening, the first paragraph of Bereishis, saying, and this counters that Aristotelian notion, which was still a significant notion at his time. Or at least that the Rambam probably had to do as well. So he's capturing that and saying that it's about creation, as opposed to the pre-eternality of the world. It's actually a
philosophical argument
in the classic sense.
Okay, so I can just agree with that on a whole bunch of levels. Usually those, and it's a Rashbam says this about many things, not just this, but one of the fundamental building blocks that Rashbam has about Bereishis is that narratives are just precedents for other things. B, he doesn't say anything about Yeshayahu. He just says, don't believe that the world has always been built up as it was. Rather, in the beginning, it doesn't tell you that there wasn't, that matter isn't eternal. Right? He's not taking any position about anti-Aristotelian position about the eternity of matter. He's just telling you that, right, that the world hasn't existed and it's built up for it. I also have no difficulty with that. So I have a hard time seeing...
No, I don't know that. It's Plato has no difficulty with that. But he's saying very simply, he's not getting into the technical aspects of it. It's a very popular kind of issue, but it's quite as clear. And it is a philosophic point.
Okay, I
timely, or it's not, it's almost irrelevant for him. It's actually not irrelevant for him, but it's very timely.
Maybe. I think he puts it, you know, historically, is that right? Moshe said this to the Jews to tell them, as opposed to, this is supposed to teach us for all time. I have a hard time seeing Rashbam as philosophic. So that's my, I have a hard time seeing it. Okay. But Ramban, on the other hand, is a really interesting response to the story. So Ramban begins by saying, what kind of question is this? How can you declare we don't need to know Bereishis? Isn't it the most important thing in the world to know? And our center just said that God created the world, and right, that he owns everything, right? So how can you claim, right, so Ramban starts off with a fundamentally different conception of what's important. And Rabbi Yitzchak starts off with the premise that really only ethics is important. Right? Metaphysics, theology, all those sorts of things are unimportant, and there's no reason the Torah would bother teaching me about this. But the right, all that matters is how I behave, and so fundamentally, Rabbi Yitzchak ends up saying, as Rashi presents him, that this narrative is necessary so that I can know that when I maintain position of possession of Eretz Yisrael, I am acting properly. Ramban says, no, it's just important to know that God created the world. Right? Certain truths are important. Right? Ramban takes an explicitly philosophic stance. There are truths that are important, and Bereishis should teach me the things that it's important for me to know. So what kind of crazy question is what Rabbi Yitzchak is asking? To which Ramban gives a fascinating answer. He says, you're right, those are really important things, but they're really important things that you can't learn from Chumash. Because Chumash is not about explaining really important things, because really important things require philosophy. Chumash is not about philosophy. To learn philosophy, you have to have a whole lot of background, which Chumash is not inclined to provide you with. And therefore, a beautiful question is not, why does Chumash tell me these things when they're unimportant? The real issue is, why does Chumash mention these things when these are the kind of things that you can only learn through reason? That's your tradition. So he reinstates Rabbi Yitzchak's question, right, by saying that the Torah can't be about philosophy, not because philosophy is unimportant, but because philosophy cannot be taught through a written text. So what is Bereishis really about then for him? So he's asking his questions. His answer is as follows. Therefore, Yitzchak said, sorry, Yitzchak gave Rashi, right, the Torah began with Bereishit bara Elokim, and everything, tell everything else, and then he gave him dominion over the works of his hands and placed everything under his foot. And at the Garden of Eden, which is the choices of the places created in this world, became his home until his sin drove him from there, and the people of the generation was blood driven from the entire world, the only the righteous among them escaping along with his children, while the sin of his descendants caused him to be scattered in various places and dispersed among the lands, so that they took places by families, opportunities to them themselves to them. This being the case, it is appropriate when a nation continues to sin, that it should lose its place, and that another nation will come to inherit its land. For this was the way of God with the land from the beginning. Okay, I want to argue that Rashtan is a really fascinating reread of Rabbi Yitzchak here. Right, he agrees, Ramban says that he agrees fundamentally that Bereshit can't be about theology or metaphysics, even though he thinks that theology and metaphysics are really important. But he says, right, so Bereshit, so really all that Bereshit is left to be about is either history or ethics from his perspective. So he agrees with Rabbi Yitzchak in the end that the purpose of Bereshit is to teach me something about ethics, but he derives an almost exactly opposite lesson from Rashi. Rashi says the purpose of Bereshit is to teach me that God created the world and he can give it to whomever he wants. Ramban says the purpose of Bereshit is to teach me that God gives land to people who deserve it. And right, and actually, right, so his reading actually is a reading not just of the creation story, it's a reading of the entire book of Genesis. The entire book of Genesis is about the relationship between virtue and land ownership. And so ultimately, the purpose of Bereshit is so that if people choose to do this in the land, they can say, God gave it to us because its previous owners deserved to lose it. Right? And the key sentence in Bereshit is, Kilo Shalem Adon Emori Adhena. Right? Even though Adam has promised the land, he can't take possession until the previous inhabitants have deserved to lose it. Okay, this reading appeals to me very, very much. And I actually think that that is a really good read, which we will do another week. I think it is a really, really good exposition of the way Chazal is Bereshit. I think that much of what Chazal do in Bereshit is exactly on point with Ramban. Bereshit in this realm is about an abstraction, but a complicated abstraction. It's about recognizing, in almost exact contrast to the way in which we read about Rashi naively, that it's about teaching us that God's actions are not random, right? And that even though the world may perceive to us may appear to us as random, actually everything that God does is motivated by justice. Yes.
Do you suppose there's a possibility that Rashi and Ramban are presenting alternate phases because those events that were taking place in the Holy Land at the time?
Could be. On the other hand, I would also say, I think that this is probably reflective of their general stances. If you look at their commentaries on Eve, this same dichotomy plays out all the way through, that Rashi thinks that the fundamental, as I recall, I haven't done it in a long time, but I was reading my own Shira on Eve, and this is what I said. Rashi's commentary on Eve is perfectly happy, saying that, well, God made it everything, so he can do whatever he wants, and Ramban's reading of Eve is all about how everything has to be justified. Ramban's notion of reading Chumash generally is built on the idea that Chumash is a world in which you can actually see justice. It's the reason, I may say this out another week, but I'll say this, I like saying this one, but I think it's really important to say that the reason that Ramban is willing to see the Avot as sinners, as opposed to most other commentaries who like to see the Avot as what are looking to be called ossified statues, etc. type piety, is that Ramban's understanding of Chumash is that in Chumash there is no unjustified suffering, and the Avot suffer. Therefore, they have to have sins. And if you look at the sins that Ramban attributes to the Avot, it's never because he reads the text in context as compellingly saying that they sinned. It's because there is some later suffering on their part that he has to justify by finding an antecedent sin. So I think this stance of Ramban is actually reflected all through his work. Now, whether that reflects to general position in history, the world isn't so great in Ramban's time, either he had a rough life. So I wouldn't want to reduce it to he didn't live through the Crusades. So he emerges as you have allegorical readings, which people have a lot of tension with, which can be resolved, and Verizon pointed out by saying that the allegory does not exclude the historical truth, but nonetheless create real tension because the historical truth becomes less significant. It becomes sort of accidentally, right? It's nice that it's true, but who really cares? Right? All that matters is the abstraction. And also the problem with that kind of reading is that you can read any text that way. Right? You can read any good novel as an allegory of relationships between God and human beings, or as I said, you can read it to be spite of it. Right? As being, right, as being about the relationship between God and human beings, or for that matter about the virtue of persistence, or for that matter about how silly human beings are. They keep on, you know, they want to leave my cold up, all they do is keep climbing up rain pipes. Knowing that eventually God's going to send the rain and wash us out, and we just keep climbing, you know. And so, right, so really, the intimacy finder is a version of the myth of Sisyphus. Right, we just keep rolling it off down, you know, when it gets, just about when it gets to the top. It may actually be, by the way, the intimacy finder may have been a popularization of the myth of Sisyphus. Okay. The question I want to ask, though, is that the question whether a text is about something, are there things about the text that are explained much better by saying that the text is about philosophy than by any other reading? The problem with allegorical reading is that the text already works perfectly well, and you're just choosing to impose the allegory on it. The question is, are the things in the text which are a giveaway that says this text is really, right, is really about these abstract questions? And the time that tells us, willingly we say, you know what? If Abraham were about Abraham and not about form, then this wouldn't be happening. And yet, keep it as convincingly that we can still read the story on that level. Right, that's the challenge I want to raise. Yes?
Well, I mean,
Well, the interesting thing is, as I said earlier, on the one hand, certainly in the first parts of Bereshit, we have a deep sympathy with the medieval rationalist's willingness to not take the story literally. On the other hand, we have an almost total disinterest in what they wanted it to mean instead. Right? That was right. So that was for medieval, we might be perfectly happy saying that the flood never really happened. It's just an allegory. But we're really not interested in how the provenance applies to species or individuals. Right? The notion that providence applies to species because species are abstractions and God is right and it would be a disgrace to God to know particulars. Right? That's like an argument which, you know, I can take it to you right now. I suspect that very few of you had a religious epiphany. As a result of that argument, although right, if you were a medieval philosopher, you would say, wow, that's really cool. So that's the problem we have. Right, based on your and the problem right, but the problem we have with pardon? Okay. Yeah, there's always a risk. There's going to be a medieval philosophy professor somewhere.
In two generations that have a thing that's important to them, and that's what they're going to focus on in their allegory.
Right. The problem is that we don't find it right is that we recognize at this stage that if we were to take the text allegorically, we wouldn't make it the same allegory that they did. That sort of indicates the text isn't really about the allegory. Right, we're imposing the allegory on the text. I would say that's the challenge. The categories they use are not categories in the whole. In the same way, and we'll talk about this in 2 weeks, that even if we have a strong urge to say that Bereshit is about science, right, we don't really want to say that Bereshit is about Aristotelian science. We want to say that Bereshit is about super string theory. Right? Pardon? Yeah. Or something like that. Yes.
It almost shows you the power of how similar to the text that allows each generation to see it in an allegory that's relevant.
Okay, so we can claim that the text is always about philosophy, and each generation has revealed to what the proper allegory is. The challenge is, what if we think some of the allegories are just wrong? Right? It was one thing to say that every generation has a message that's relevant, but if we now look back at, let's say, in the 13th century, it was revealed to us that a certain aspect of the text, right, demonstrates the phlogiston theory of, right, of combustion. Right, and I was just thinking, well, wrong, right? There is no such thing as phlogiston. Right, or other things taught us, right, how, right, about how, right, about how, right, how certain things propagate in the ether. Right, and I don't believe that there's ether, right? So that would be, we have to have a complicated thing which we say that every generation learns something which teaches it some little bit of science and happens luckily to conform to, right, what the science is. Now that doesn't convince me. Right? And we'll talk about that too, but it doesn't convince me. Yes.
Just methodologically, yeah. Can we just interesting allegory, we project a whole scheme onto the text which doesn't necessarily have any connection to the text, like Abraham is swan,
right. Whatever
it matters. And other types of readings for meaning, you know, for, you know, some kind, you call it abstracting, but readings for philosophical meaning, they are more rooted in the actual terms of the text, the dynamics and semantics of the text. I mean, the first chapter of creation is talking about creation. It makes some sense that you could actually, from the semantics of the text itself, come up with some ideas about that those reflect scientific ideas or philosophic ideas, not as a projected allegory, but, you know, coming out of the text itself, the way the Rambam tries to be.
Okay, so I think that's the same challenge I'm reading. Is there something, right, you know, what I'm looking for is there something in the text which I can say that reading it as looked for this kind of meaning explains the text better than if I didn't? Right? This text wouldn't make sense unless I thought it was trying to convey this. Like, for example, the Rav argues that the text is clearly trying to teach me something about the dual nature of human beings. Right? It can't be telling me something about history because it contradicts itself. Right? Texts are trying to teach me history, don't contradict themselves. Right? In the same way that, you know, that a compelling argument for the truth of Midrash Halakha is that the Torah contradicts itself regularly. So obviously it's not supposed to be read in the manner of a text that doesn't contradict itself. It has to be read in the manner that accounts for the text contradicting itself. So the same account, right, same token, right, if a plausible reading says, here we have a text which contradicts itself, it must be trying to convey some kind of meaning which is best conveyed by contradiction. Okay, now it might be that certain aspects of Bereshit are read most compellingly that way. That you can read the first paragraph of Bereshit and say that, you know what, let's say, you might make the argument that Bereshit teaches me that there was light before there was any source of light. Right, that's right. It seems to that's one message of the creation of the first day. Well, that must teach me that there are other forms of radiation. Right, which, you know, that, you know, and it teaches me about background radiation and the cosmic constants and whatever else you want. Right, that's not implausible. I tend to be skeptical, but that's making the kind of argument I would look for, right? You have to say, like, no physical, right, that it's not at all clear why any coherent narrative trying to explain the world as it is. Now, anybody trying to explain the world as it is would not begin by saying there was light before there were sources of light. So the claim that there was light before there were sources of light must be making some kind of claim, right, some kind of claim, deeper claim of that reality. I'm open to that kind of argument. I don't tend to be convinced by it, but I'm open by it. And based on that, we could then, right, and understand, once we have it legitimated that way, then we can say, aha, the term bara must have specific meaning and must be opposed to asiyani sira in very specifically defined ways. And now we can go through Bereshit and analyze, why does it say bara about Shemayim v'aretz and human beings and tanim gedolim? Right, what is there metaphysically different about tanim gedolim that generates the word bara? And that's a really interesting question. I want to say that there are two things, right, there are two things in the text that to me are indications that reading Bereshit, not just for ethics. I mean, obviously, you can read Bereshit for ethics. I think the case that you can read Bereshit for anthropology has been made so well it doesn't need to be repeated. The interesting question to me is, are there still a way in which we can say convincingly that we think Bereshit is about theology, abstract theology, not about just knowing how God behaves in the world? That abstraction is about the nature of God, that it's about metaphysics and about epistemology. And is there a way in which we can read the text and say, look, the text is much better explained that way. There are phenomena in the text that don't work well unless we make the assumption that Bereshit is really about these things. So there are two things that drive me in that direction. The first one I get from Professor Wynne Evan Bivens, who is now at Vanderbilt University. So he used to be much cooler to describe him as a Hawaiian Jewish philosopher. When Evan Bivens when he was at the University of Hawaii. But in a book called Monotheism, which I think he thinks has been supplanted by a later work called The God of Abraham, but I'm still more into the earlier book. I was younger, I had lots more time to read any books then. So the argument which I thought was really cool. And she said that the tetragrammaton, the four names of God, is just totally acontextual. It doesn't have any cultural context in the ancient Near East. If you assume, which I think is a very plausible reading, that the full name of God is a philosophic claim about God as the source of being. So it is all the tenses of the verb to be rolled into one. Now, if you take that reading of the full name of God, which I think is a compelling textual reading, then you say, well, what is this radically abstract notion of God doing in the middle of the ancient Near East? It just doesn't fit. So he actually uses that as evidence, I think, really, you know, not bad, for the divinity of Sarah. But I want to argue that, you know, that whether or not you buy that aspect of the argument, it's just a clue that something, right, that this is that, right, that the text is not uninterested in radical abstractions. Right, because in the, if you just read an argument as such, so then, right, in this case, some version of the Harachamim, right, is right, of God is transcendent, all those things might be conveyed better than by this wild abstraction of God as all tenses of being simultaneously. That to me is a really interesting prima facie case that so much is not uninterested. It's teaching you something, but just by that name, it's trying to teach you something profound about the nature of God. Not about ethics, not about history. The second, which I actually find really, really cool, is the last G, which is the story of Yggdrasil. The story of Yggdrasil has many, many meanings, and I don't want to claim that the meaning I'm going to offer now is the only meaning by any means, but there are certain features of the text of Yggdrasil that only make sense to be read a certain way. The core of it is in verses 14 through, in lines 14 through 16, it says in the middle, right, when they settle in the valley of Shinar, they say one to the other, let us, how about, right, this is, right, they're in a land where everybody speaks one tongue, and they say, how about Yilvana Levenim, the Nitrafa Litrifa, Tapihilahana Levena Leaven, Beachemer Ayalahan Lachomer. Okay, now, usually the way I teach is as follows. I ask students which of the following translations of this verse is better. And someone served them in place of brick and quick line in place of putty, or the translation I give you, stone served in place of rock, or the translation I give you, and brick served them in place of rock, and pitch became to them putty. Usually no one gets it. Brick and rock, why? The Hebrew goes out of its way to describe both substances, right, with similar sounding words. Right? Living now, which is brick, serves with oven as rock, as chemer, which is some kind of artificial substance, serves to them in place of stoner. And it does this after going out of its way to, right, how the Nilbanal living in the Shafala Shaita. Right. So it seems to me that that any serious reading of Yggdrasil has to account for why it's so important to make the words, right, to make the words sound alike. Okay. And to tie this into the, once we start looking at this, we discover that the story of Yggdrasil is surrounded by Abel Bnei Shem and Abel Toldot Shem. And the story of Yggdrasil is all about the people who want to not to learn Shem. And in the end, I'll think to rush him up. Alright, so we have a story in the genealogy of names. So that the whole story is built as a pun on the word name. And the word names means multiple things, right? The genealogy of the person made of the person named name, right? Name name. There were people who wanted to make themselves a name, and they got a name, but not the name they wanted. Now, for the name, right? So, right now, the way they wanted to make themselves a name was by going up to name. So we have a whole story which is predicated over and over again on the word name, and showing how the same word can mean different things, which has at its literary core a claim that a moment where artificial things replace natural things, but the artificial things have names that are just like the natural things. So it seems to me that really it's hard to read the story without taking the position that when you say that the land all had, everyone spoke one language, what that means is that once upon a time there was a natural language. And what a natural language is, a language in which sound and meaning are organically connected, not that three tables sat around and one of them said, let's take a rock, right? This is a rock, okay? And one of them said rock, and the second one said heaven. And the third, right? And the third one said Peter. And they sorted out, and it went right, and the person who said rock won. So the rock became that way. Right? Not the same one, right? But really, there was no reason it couldn't be rock, heaven, or Peter. It just happened to be those are the random sounds that came out of your mouth. No, right? Really, there was a time when there was a word which, right, in the fabric of the universe, there was a connection between language and being. And what human beings did was they figured out that connection. And so when they needed things that could serve in place of rock, they said, what would sound like rock? Let's find it. And they found things that sounded like rock and said, look, things that sound like rock are hard. Right? And if you could look at something and know what its name was, then you could develop, right, then you could develop technology. Okay, now we know that this is important to human beings, because when we recognize that the story is about that kind of, is about how we lost that original language, and we understand why it was impressive that and why it was important that God brought the only animals to the human being to see what he would call them. And what does that mean? When God brought the zebra to human beings and he wanted to find out if he would even call them Jeff, or Frank, right, or zebra, who cares, right? Right, the call of Shriker, well, Adam, right, who should know, whatever even called that was his name, of course. Who else was going to call it? No, the human beings were capable of understanding the original language. Now, what does it mean to be able to know the relationship between language and existence? That's what God does in creation. Right, God creates by speech. So the story of Yigdal Zavel is about how human beings having the secret of natural speech use it to produce technology. But what they want to do with technology is they want to capture the capacity to be able to create it. They want to build Yigdal, which had its great. And Yigdal, by the way, is something which makes it great. So this is a reading which to me, once you notice that phenomenon, that you should recognize, of course, that Levina Levinala Oven is a false pun. There is no connection between Levina and Oven. The Lama is fake. Why? Because the Torah is written after we lost natural language. Right? So we have an attempt to show in conventional language what it was like to live with natural language. Right, so this to me is once you look at it, to me it's like that's what Yigdal Zavel is saying. And if that's what Yigdal Zavel is saying, all of a sudden we have a story in Bereishis which is about epistemology and theology and metaphysics. And once we have a story in Bereishis which is about epistemology and theology and metaphysics, then all of a sudden we have to ask the question whether all the other stories are about that as well. My overall argument is as follows. I think that the ways in which the Rishonim read Bereishis is about philosophy are not terribly convincing to us now, and the critiques of the critique of the Rashba is powerful. The readings about the readings that celebration about ethics are perfectly fine because we're perfectly comfortable. But I think that there are ways of reading nowadays also which suggest that Bereshit is actually about those kind of abstractions. The difficulty with that is that since we have a whole set of categories, we have to deal with the same challenge raised earlier, is that if we think Bereshit is about abstractions, we are likely to think that they are about abstractions in a way which are not necessarily the same abstractions that people thought they were about traditionally, and so we have to deal, as always, with what it means to come up with important new readings of Chumash. To come up with trivial readings of Chumash is not a religious problem. But to come up with important new readings of Chumash is a religious challenge. So while I think that at this point I think that, I look at me double bell and just jumped out of me and I can't read any other way. And if me double bell is about that, then it's hard to argue that isn't a legitimate way of looking at other things as well. But I don't want to claim that this is an unchallenging topic. Michael, you had a question.
Yeah. So I never heard that explanation me double bell. Is that make you committed to the view that all Jews throughout history cannot know what Mi'dabod all about?
So again, as I say, this is the challenge. I recognize the challenge that you call it important in reading. Now, is it more of a challenge than, let's say, Nassif discovering that Mi'dabod all is anti-totalitarian? I suspect that I can probably find narrative Midrashim that make this point in the same way that Nitziv found, right, Nitziv correctly, I think, argues that when Chazal plays Nimrod as the king of Babel, right, what they're saying is that Midal Babel was a totalitarian society.
Well, something
that forces us
into looking at
Torah in this way, or
assuming my assumption was the way we
should
look at
the Torah. No, I think Nitziv said as follows. There is no possible way that could happen without this totalitarian regime. And you just said, and anybody who knows anything about politics, human nature, should have realized that. I think that's kind of stupid. Now, I want to be careful, because I don't think this is all that the government knows about. I think this is right, too. I think that it's an aspect that probably many classical readers of Mi'dabod, right, were not aware of. On the other hand, what I would say is that then this notion is a chiddush to modern ears because we all have imbibed conventional notions of language, but for traditional Jews prior to the 19th century, it was still that Hebrew was the original language. If we say Kabbalistic backgrounds and they assume that Hebrew was an ontological significance, so then this is Varmish and Abikas, of course. Everybody spoke Hebrew, right? And then, right, this is the other tradition made. Everybody spoke Hebrew, and Hebrew is Lashon HaKodesh. And Lashon HaKodesh means, right, the language in which God made, the language in which the Torah was written, in which God created the world. Right, so all that, right, what's radical about my reading in a traditional sense is that I don't think the natural language is the Hebrew that we have. Other than that, right, reading the Dalai Lama is a story about the loss by most of humanity of natural language and by the rest of humanity of the understanding that it is natural language. We can still make the sounds, but we no longer realize when we speak Hebrew that we describe the essences. Right, that, I think, is a very conventional reading for you. Okay, that's it. Back then, that was just an assumption. It wasn't that you wouldn't have done use my textual reading to demonstrate that if everyone knew that. Okay. Oh, that's pretty heavy. Thank you. And thank you as always, Ben. I love coming to the Shul of Teaching because you let me do things like this. I hope you'll come back and bring friends in 2 weeks, or if you join at the Khan Academy next 2 weeks. Thank you very much, Peter.